May it please the court, counsel, my name is Doug Phoebus and I represent Kamud Gupta, who was hired for the 1997-98 school year by the Madison Metropolitan School District. After her hiring, she was assigned to teach English as a second language science classes. Her supervisor was Barbara Nolan, the assistant principal. At the end of that year, Barbara Nolan made a written recommendation that Ms. Gupta receive a non-renewal for her teaching contract, and that action was ultimately taken. This is a 1981 claim for employment discrimination. The district court ruled that the claimants had failed to establish elements 2 and elements 4 of the McDonnell-Douglas test, and additionally that even if she had established those things, she failed to establish pretext. Sure, absolutely. When Ms. Gupta filed this complaint, the Seventh Circuit decisions had indicated that in Wisconsin, a 1981 action needed to be commenced within 6 years. Following the dismissal on summary judgment by the district court in this matter, the United States Supreme Court came down with the Jones v. R&R Donnelly case, which indicated a subsequent federal statute had in fact made the statute of limitations for a 1981 claim 4 years. And I should preface that a 1981 claim that did not survive the Patterson decision from 1990. And so Ms. Gupta's complaint was filed more than 4 years after the termination, but less than 6 years. So if we relied on prior Seventh Circuit precedent, her complaint would be timely, but the decision in R&R Donnelly following the Smith-List case, if you followed retroactively applied that decision to this matter, then her complaint would not be timely. The defense did raise a statute of limitations issue in their pleadings. The reason it doesn't apply is two cases. The first seminal case is the Chevron case. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case which discusses retroactivity of the Supreme Court decisions. My belief on reading the case law is that Chevron and the St. Francis College would still be the controlling precedent, and the defense in their briefs asserted that as well. So. I am not, Judge.
But as I read it, if Chevron is no longer in good retroactivity analysis in civil cases, then the court decisions are presumptively against the last civil and criminal cases.
I'm trying to think and. Is it possible that that was a concurring opinion within Harper?
No. Unfortunately, it's the real McCoy.
Yeah. Okay. Obviously, I was prepared to discuss the cases the defense and I briefed here today and not the Harper case.
Well, if Harper, if I'm right about Harper and that Chevron is no longer good law, and that pursuant to Harper in civil cases, judicial decisions are retroactive. Two cases still pending, and conduct not yet been litigated, and cases on time and
if that is the law, correct. If the Chevron and the St. Francis College decision remain the law, then our case would be timely. Would the court like to entertain my argument on the merits? I'd like to discuss first the fourth element of the McDonnell-Douglas analysis, the others similarly situated. I believe that while Ms. Gupta has proven that element of the case, she did not need to. Under the Yarbrough decision, which was cited by the plaintiffs, this court indicated that that where the alleged complaint is one instance of discrimination, termination from employment, it is not necessary to present evidence that similarly situated white employees were treated more favorably than Mr. Yarbrough in that case. So I believe the Yarbrough analysis applies to this case. However, we did prove the similarly situated element of it. Number one, just from the defense briefs, they concede that Mel Burris was a white ESL teacher of probationary status. She was evaluated by Barbara Nolan, and she was not terminated. Additionally, Ms. Gupta testified that Ms. Burris was not evaluated the third day, was not observed as frequently by Ms. Nolan, and did not have to meet with Ms. Nolan as frequently. Therefore, you've got a similarly situated employee being treated differently. Ms. Gupta was treated less favorably. Additionally, we presented the testimony of Ed Sadlowski, who's a representative from the union, and he indicated that there was a meeting 1 year after the school year started where the June Glennon, who's head of employment relations for the school district, indicated that the school district was ready to go to non-renewal unless Ms. Gupta resigned. Mr. Sadlowski said he had never before seen the school district prepared to go to non-renewal after 1 month. I would respectfully suggest that that also shows that similarly situated employees were not treated the same as Ms. Gupta. Finally, while the district court did analyze the case under a McDonnell-Douglas analysis, I believe there was direct evidence of discrimination in that the first time that Mrs. Nolan met Ms. Gupta, she immediately asked her, "Where are you from?" We believe that is direct evidence and that it would become a jury question as to the pretext issues in the case. The district court... Well, my inference... Well, that's Ms. Nolan's interpretation of what she meant. I agree.
I think that the lady's English was less than perfect.
Well, I don't think that that's in the record, but that's true.
So that would, at the observation with the thing, wouldn't it be a logical, friendly question to say where you're from?
Well, academically, that's one interpretation, but isn't that really for the jury? Because the inference in your voice...
The problem with that was almost anything now becomes a jury question. Whether he raised his eyebrows at the time he started to speak, or he turned sideways. There are things that are capable of absolutely innocent. It has nothing to do with racial discrimination. The fact is, they observed her and they decided she was a lousy teacher. That's what it amounted to, isn't it?
Well, that is the explanation given by the school district. However, when you look at the objective things that you can actually... Well, if you look at their criticisms, one criticism was she failed to consult with colleagues, when in fact we presented evidence that in fact she had been consulting with her colleagues and the counseling staff. One criticism was a lesson plan. One particular lesson plan was not up to par. Meanwhile, when that lesson plan was brought up and shown to the representative from the union, Ms. Nolan could not identify anything wrong with that lesson plan. Ms. Nolan singled out one student's conduct. The student was acting up in class and said, therefore, Ms. Gupta wasn't disciplining and controlling her class. Meanwhile, she failed to show that this student was a problem in everyone's class. And had been M-teamed. When I asked Ms. Nolan, did you look to see if Ms. Gupta was testing the students? Because testing is the hallmark of the American academic institution, she indicated she didn't know and she never looked at any tests. And I would submit the proof is in the pudding. We filed testing. The testing was adequate. I see that I've exceeded my whole test. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
May it please the court, my name is David Rohr, and I'm here on behalf of the defendants, Madison Metropolitan School District, and Barbara Nolan, a former assistant principal. And I must confess, I was prepared to come up here and actually talk about how clever I was to anticipate the statute of limitations reversal in the Jones v. Donnelly case. But as Judge Sykes has pointed out, in her opinion, Chevron is no longer good law as to retroactivity. So I did not discuss the Harper case in our brief. I did discuss Chevron. And I was aware that Chevron was at least called into question, but I can't say that I was prepared to argue that Chevron is no longer good law. In any event, I did discuss it. What's that? Right. And in any event, we did timely raise it, as counsel has conceded, and we even asked the district court to hold off on deciding this case in summary judgment because we knew the Supreme Court would be deciding the case here. But the court went ahead and decided it anyway, and we did preserve it. In terms of the retroactivity issue, I anticipated they would argue that in our response brief, and certainly a lot more effort on that issue might have been worthwhile. In any event, I did recognize that the presumption is that judicial decisions are retroactive, and I think that's the principle that that Harper would put into place. As to the merits of the case, there are a number of ways in which the plaintiff's case falls short. One is that the plaintiff is coming here before you saying that the district court ignored many of the facts that were proffered by them on summary judgment. The fact is that the plaintiff did not follow the local rules on summary judgment, and the district court made note of that and made a finding to that effect. So for the plaintiff to come up here now and say that the district court missed all of these facts and summary judgment was improper, I think that's something that plaintiff should not be allowed to do at this stage. Plaintiff's going to have to live with those facts that they didn't properly dispute. The district court on the merits found not only that there was no evidence of pretext, but also that the plaintiff had failed to establish a prima facie case. The two elements, one being that she had failed to show that she was meeting the employer's legitimate expectations, and all that she offered on that score, even looking at her so-called evidence, was her subjective belief that she was doing a good job. She also failed to establish the fourth element of a prima facie case by not showing any evidence that she was treated less favorably than similarly situated employees not in the protected category. There were several individuals that she tried to point to, Ann Pumper, and Ann Pumper was a probationary teacher at the same time at Memorial High School, but she was evaluated by a different person, so therefore she's not similarly situated. There was a Frank Zerner that she mentioned, but he was a 35-year veteran teacher, and the idea that the assistant principal is going to come in and observe her or him 18 times isn't very persuasive. The only other one they offered was Nell Burris, and they put in no evidence as to what kind of evaluations she got, how many times she was observed, when she first started being observed, and so forth. So the district court's ruling on that score is sound. As to evidence of pretext, there was simply none. Plaintiff's counsel mentioned test results, that Barbara Nolan did not look at the fact that some of her students, Gupta students, had done well on tests. And Barbara Nolan admitted that she didn't really look at that. And if you look at Exhibit O to the Bob Nadler affidavit, actually on page 44, that was the transcript of the private conference. When this argument was raised, the labor contract manager for the district pointed out that the union prevented them from evaluating teachers based on test results. And so, of course, Barbara Nolan couldn't be expected to do that. So that issue has been addressed. My opponent makes reference to testimony by Ed Sadlowski and other testimony, but that comes from this Exhibit O, which is the transcript of the private conference. None of that was sworn testimony. And so when he talks about the testimony of Ed Sadlowski, that's not the type of evidence that's admissible under Rule 56, because it's not the equivalent of an affidavit or a deposition. It's simply a transcript of unsworn comments that were made at this private conference. We gave, during the depositions, we gave Ms. Gupta plenty of opportunity to explain the basis for her claim of discrimination. The comment that she came up with was, well, where was she from, was the first thing that Ms. Nolan said, and that simply is not evidence of discrimination. It's a pretty common greeting that you might expect from anybody, so there's no inference that can be drawn from that. The other thing she mentioned was that, well, Ms. Nolan was going to come in and observe her the third day of class, and she thought that was discriminatory. But again, that was something that Ms. Nolan was required to do classroom observations. And the fact that she did it 18 times, those were not evaluations, those were observations that formed the basis for her evaluations. So there's no inference here that can be drawn of discrimination. One other point that she tried to raise as evidence of pretext was the treatment of a colleague of hers by the name of Gita Dewar. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right. Ms. Gupta claimed that Gita Dewar was at Memorial High School at the same time Ms. Gupta was, and that after Barbara Nolan talked to her, she was no longer there. Somehow she lost her contract. Well, that just doesn't make sense, and that's not in fact what occurred. Ms. Dewar never had a regular contract at Memorial. She was there substituting and then was shifted over to another school on a long-term subcontract. I understand that. I think I am done if there are no other questions, and thank you.